This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Welcome to today's program. We open today with an ancient verse called Dedication of Merit from the Chinese Buddhist tradition, translated and sung by the American monk Hen Xue. He describes how his translation and song came about like this. The song, Dedication of Merit, was born as an antidote to the grief and helplessness following 9/11 and the fall of the Two Towers. 250 Buddhists and Catholics had gathered at a Benedictine convent in Indiana to investigate the rule of St. Benedict from a Buddhist perspective. Sister Mary Margaret Funk invited the Buddhists to provide a dedication of merit, a practice of sharing with the world all the goodness created by any wholesome action. Using the mind to broadcast goodness is an effective form of spiritual activism. The abbot of the city of 10,000 Buddhas and I accepted the challenge, and the night before the conference concluded, we managed to translate into English the 1,300-year-old Chinese Buddhist verse. Needing a tune, my thoughts spontaneously recalled Lorena McKennett's Dark Soul of the Night. I matched our translation and her melody, and they joined like body and soul. The next day, the participants, holding candles, processed out to the driveway of the convent, around the white marble image of the Blessed Virgin Mary, who resembles in so many ways Guan Yin Bodhisattva, the awakened being of great compassion. I introduced this new song, saying, "After meritorious deeds of any sort, a Bodhisattva, an awakened being, can share the goodness with the world by making a wish and dedicating the merit. The scope of your mind and the sincerity of your heart determines the efficacies of your vows. When, as today, so many hearts dedicate together, the effect can change the world in profound ways." On that September day, 1 week after the attack in New York, our hearts that sought relief and healing carried our wishes aloft, borne by the new song. Miss McKennett's melody delivered healing. We could almost see the thoughts of the assembly take form and rise on the wings of sacred music. Dozens of people came forward afterwards and thanked me for the unexpected healing delivered by a Buddhist Catholic liturgy, a song that sounded to them as familiar as a hymn and as powerful as prayer. This experience demonstrated to me the ability of music to move the heart and benefit the world beyond religious boundaries. At another Buddhist Christian meeting, after I heard a fellow guitar player, Father Cyprian Consiglio, lead the singing of intercessory prayers, I said to him, "We Buddhists have the same kind of practice," and told him about the song. After hearing it sung by my Buddhist congregation, he asked if he might sing it. He and his collaborator, John Pennington, adapted it a bit from my version, adding percussion and a Sanskrit chant, the Metta-Bhavana mantra. Since that day, Cyprian has performed the song to conclude liturgies and concerts around the globe, from India to Italy, from New Jersey to New Mexico. He calls it compassionate and wise, and he reports the same response. People feel healed by the tune.
Sarvesham Sastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavantu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinam Sarve Shantu Niramayam Sarve Bhadrani Pushantu Makashudukam Bhagavate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Father Cyprian introduces his version. This is an intercessory prayer taught to me by my Buddhist brother monk, Reverend Heng Shu. The lyric is translated from Chinese, and its melodic setting was written by a gifted Canadian composer, Lorena McKennett. She wrote the melody for a verse by a Catholic mystic, St. John of the Cross. I'm a Roman Catholic hermit, and I've added a Sanskrit peace mantra to it to bring it full circle. I'm on this bridge to world peace, and I'm staying on it. Now, I opened today's program with this beautiful dedication and story because I thought they're a testament to the power of dedication. In Buddhism, when we dedicate the power of our positive actions to a goal or to the well-being of others, often we don't really know what the result will be. Or we are told, oh, the result will be this or that. But that's something we have to take on trust. We very rarely come face to face with the outcome. For instance, in the Theravada traditions, we offer puja and so on for those departed, hoping that it will be of some benefit to them. And in the Mahayana traditions, we might dedicate to the benefit of all living beings. But apart from our own feel-good factor, we can't really say whether our dedications make the departed ones happier or that we've made a difference in the lives of sentient beings, can we? However, here, Venerable Heng Shu and the Benedictine monk Father Cyprian Consiglio show us how dedication can bring people together in peace and harmony. And then, because our hearts are one, this world of pain turns into paradise. And so, as we come to the end of the text we've been following, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by the Indian master Shantideva, you might have wondered why we and the author spend so much time on dedication. We've been exploring the dedicatory verses of this final chapter for the last 5 programs, and we're still at it. But it is important. As Venerable Heng Shu says, using the mind to broadcast goodness is an effective form of spiritual activism, and it can work for us both now and in times to come. As important as dedication, if not more so, is motivation. And so, before we go any further, let's make sure our motivation for the program today is as effective as it can be. Let's take the last line of Venerable Heng Shu's verse, "May all become compassionate and wise to its furthest limit, and make the wish that all become enlightened." Thank you. And now on to Shantideva's verses once more. After the verses we covered in the last program, which are, "May all embodied creatures uninterruptedly hear the sound of Dharma issuing from birds and trees, beams of light and even space itself. May they always meet with Buddhas and their sons, the Bodhisattvas. Then may these spiritual masters of the world be worshipped with endless clouds of offerings. May celestials bring timely rains so that harvests may be bountiful. May kings act in accordance with the Dharma and the people of the world always prosper. May all medicines be effective and the repeating of mantras successful. May dakinis, cannibals and the like be endowed with compassionate minds." He concludes with, "May no living creature ever suffer, commit evil or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled or their minds ever be depressed." Kunzun Peldon makes the point that committing evil is the cause of suffering, and so that beings never giving in to evil would result in their never becoming ill. Perhaps the last 2 lines have a particular poignancy and meaning for today's world because of social media. In the past, it was difficult to belittle and bully others unless you did it face to face, and seeing their pain often put a brake on what you would say or do. Now, with the internet, you can say the most vile things to and about someone else, and not only do you not have to face them, but your poison can reach a far wider audience than it could possibly do before. And so we hear of teenagers made so miserable by the nastiness of their peers, even sometimes so-called friends, that they fall into depression to the point of suicide. So, we too can make this dedication with an extra dimension in mind, thinking, "May social media and all forms of communication become vehicles for praise, harmony, and goodwill, and be free of any trace of vindictiveness." Now Shantideva dedicates to those who've taken vows and live as monastics. In all temples and monasteries, may reading and recitation flourish and remain. May the Sangha always be in harmony, and may their purposes be accomplished. Kunzen Peldon's take on this verse goes like this. In all temples and monasteries, great or small, wherever the scriptures are present, may the Tripitaka be explained, listened to, and reflected upon. May the sutras and the rest be retained in the mind and never forgotten. May they be recited. May they be remembered, and their meaning meditated upon one pointedly. In brief, in all monasteries, may the activities of the Buddha's followers, the abandonment of defilement, the practice of concentration, learning and study, flourish and remain for a long time. By contrast, in places of trade and agriculture where people are enslaved by wealth and tormented by attachment and aversion with respect to each other, and where they are distracted night and day by constant enmity, quarreling and spiteful grudges, and especially in places where there are conflicts in the Sangha, the qualities and experiences can never arise, just as burnt seeds can never produce green shoots. As the scriptures say, get thee hence 100 leagues from places where contention spread. Thus, wherever the monastic order finds itself, may the ordained never be divided by demonic forces. May their minds be inclined to virtue. May they bring their discipline in conformity with Upasatha, the ritual purification and restoration of vows at the full and new moon. May they make their view conform with the Upasatha of calm abiding. And in accordance with their wish, may they acquire ever more extraordinary qualities of the path of liberation beyond suffering, which is their goal. Now, one of the most serious downfalls against the monk's vows is to cause a schism in the Sangha. That is, to create disharmony among a community of monks. Of course, if the mind is not controlled, it very easily finds cause for quarrels and disagreements, and closely keeping the monk's vows helps to keep it well subdued. Thus, harmony and peace are maintained in a well-disciplined community. Nevertheless, people being what they are, even the vows are not 100% safeguard against the ego play of some. And so, even in monastic situations, things can go awry, and monks or nuns will start taking sides against each other. For that reason, those living in monastic communities meet every 2 weeks, both to confess transgressions of vows to their fellow monastics and to recite the Pratimoksha Sutra, the Sutra on the Monastic Discipline. And this is what Kunzen Peldon means by bringing the discipline in conformity with the Upasatha, the ritual purification and restoration of vows at the full and new moon. But the word Upasatha can also apply to lay people, and the well-known monk and author Bhikkhu Kantipolo describes it fully like this. The word means entering to stay, in the Buddhist sense, in a vihara or a monastery. But it has a long history before Buddhist times, as it was the customs of the Brahmins to perform the Vedic rites and sacrifices, to go to the sacred place away from their homes and families and purify themselves by leading a secluded life for a day and a night, returning after the rites were finished. The days when they kept the seclusion were determined by the phases of the moon, the most important being the full moon and the new moon days. 2 other days, the quarter moon days, were also observed. In the Buddha time, various groups of ascetics and wanderers used the traditional full and new moon days for expounding their theories and practices, while the Buddha allowed bhikkhus to assemble on those days to listen to the recitation of the Pratimoksha, the fundamental rules of a bhikkhu, and to teach Dharma to the lay people who came to their monastery. From that time down to the present, the Upasatha days have been observed by Buddhists, both ordained and laity, in all Buddhist countries. And then he continues, the origin of the Upasatha days in Buddhist teachings is found in the following story. The occasion was this. The Blessed One was living at Rajgaya on the Vulture Peak Rock, and at that time, wanderers of other sects were in the habit of meeting together on the half moons of the 14th and 15th and the quarter moon of the 8th and preaching about Dharma. People went to hear about the Dharma from them. They grew fond of the wanderers of other sects and believed in them. So the wanderers gained support. Now, while Saniya Bimbisara, king of Magadha, was alone in retreat, he considered this, and he thought, why should the venerable ones not meet together too on these days? Then he went to the Blessed One and told him what he'd thought, adding, Lord, it would be good if the venerable ones met together too on these days. The Blessed One instructed the king with a talk on the Dharma, after which the king departed. Then the Blessed One made this the occasion for a discourse on the Dharma, and he addressed the bhikkhus thus, Bhikkhus, I allow meetings on the half moons of the 14th and 15th and the quarter moon of the 8th. So the bhikkhus met together on those days, as allowed by the Blessed One, but they sat in silence. People went to hear the Dharma. They were annoyed, and they murmured and protested, How can the monks, the sons of the Sakyans, meet together on these days and sit in silence, dumb as hogs? Ought not the Dharma to be preached when they meet? Bhikkhus heard this. They went to the Blessed One and told him. He made this the occasion for a discourse on the Dharma, and he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, when there's a meeting on the half moons of the 14th and 15th and the quarter moon of the 8th, I allow preaching of the Dharma. And this is from the life of the Buddha, translated by the late Bhikkhu Nanamoli. We can see from this that the Upasata day was already popular at that time. In fact, India had already a lunar calendar. The Buddha sometimes allowed popular practices when he'd investigated them to see whether they were profitable. In this case, he saw that there were advantages for Dharma practice in the Upasata days, so he allowed them. Bhikkhu Kantipolo then goes on to investigate the significance of observing the Upasata on the full and new moon days. If the timing of the Upasata days was just to fit in with the existing practices, he asks, why shouldn't those of us who want to practice the purification days but do not follow the lunar calendar choose days more suitable to our way of life, like weekends? Is there any other significance to the Upasata days falling on the phases of the moon, he asks, and then finds an answer in the field of biology that studies the occurrence of cyclic patterns in living organisms and their adaptation to solar and lunar-related rhythms. As far as I can see, he wrote this in 1995, so his time references might be somewhat out. But he writes, A fairly new branch of biology called chronobiology studies the rhythmicity in nature and appears to support the importance of the Upasata days, particularly the full moon observance. Dr. W. Menaker of New York, writing in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, has observed, as the result of an analysis of data on birth and conception, that the coincidences between the lunar month of 29.53 days and the average duration of the menstrual cycle of 29 and a half days, and he quotes, constitutes a combination of circumstances that points to the synodic lunar month as the time unit of the human sexual reproductive cycle. Synodic means relating to or involving the conjunction of stars, planets, or other celestial objects. Kantipolo goes on, It seems as though the keeping of the Upasata days by large numbers of the Buddhist lay people until recent times will have helped to limit the growth of the population in Buddhist countries. Some people have also observed that sexual desire comes to a peak with a full moon. Those who understand that restraint in this and other sensual appetites is good will see that there is good cause for keeping at least the full moon as an Upasata day. Chronobiologists are now working on the assumption that as the oceans are affected by the moon, so the water in the body is also affected. As our body is about two-thirds sea and one-third land, we must sustain tidal effects, said Dr. Menaker. This seems reasonable, looked at from the teaching given on the elements by the Buddha. Whatever is internal liquid element and whatever is external liquid element, just these are the liquid element. Though the context for this quotation is the development of insight. At any rate, development in the Dharma goes in the direction of becoming less affected by desires concerning the body, for to have such desires is to have a defiled mind. The defilements and passions can best be controlled when they can be seen, when they're strongest. It is impossible to restrain defilements in oneself when they're not apparent, although they may operate underground. For instance, the person who is well provided with wealth and comforts may not be able to see greed or aversion at work in himself. These defilements have not surfaced, since the sea of satisfied desires in which they swim is deep enough. But place this person in a bare little hut with poor food only once a day and a strict discipline to control his actions, and then see what happens. The monsters of the deep all rise to the surface and clamor for more extensive waters in which to sport. On the other hand, the attitude of good bhikkhus shows the right way to deal with defilements. Some of the strongest, sensuality and sloth, manifest themselves at night. So the night was recommended by the Buddha as the time when they could be tackled most effectively. An enemy that one has not seen and known cannot be defeated, but an enemy well known and attacked with the weapons of right effort, right mindfulness, and right collectedness has no hope to win. It is the same on Upasada days, he concludes. The defilements that show themselves then can be restrained and limited with the aid of the Upasada discipline, which includes the 8 precepts. Now, I'm not sure what Kunzen Peldon means by the Upasada of calm abiding, unless he's talking about entering to stay in calm abiding, otherwise known as shamatha. But enough about Upasada, let's now continue with Shantideva's verses. He writes, "May monks desiring to practice find quiet and solitary places, and through having abandoned all wandering thoughts, may they meditate with flexible minds. May nuns be materially sufficient, abandon quarreling with each other, and be unharmed. Similarly, may all ordained ones never let their morality weaken. Having repented any moral falls, may evil always be eradicated, and thereby obtaining a happy state of birth, may spiritual conduct not decline even there." And Kunzen Peldon comments, "May the monks who wish to school themselves in the 3 precious trainings find perfect solitude, outer, inner, and secret. And having found it, may they abandon all busy activity and every distraction. With full control over their minds, in allowing them either to move or remain still, may they acquire the bliss that comes from perfect flexibility of mind and body. May they joyfully practice profound concentration." The 3 precious trainings here refers to moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. And referring to outer, inner, and secret solitude, Trulshi Grimbache says, retreat requires the outer solitude of the physical environment, which basically means that we need to stay somewhere away from all the hustle and bustle of a busy town, somewhere that is quiet and peaceful. Secondly, there needs to be the inner solitude of one's own body, meaning we need to stay by ourselves. We do this in order to reduce the disturbing emotions of attachment and aversion, which are the main disturbing emotions, together with ignorance. The first 2 kinds of solitude are just really supports for the 3rd kind of solitude, which is the secret solitude within one's own mind. This is the most important of the 3. Even if we stay in a remote place, if we're caught up in all kinds of thoughts and emotions within our minds, it does not really help us to be in a isolated location. And there we'll have to leave the commentary on the other verses because time is up. We'll continue next time. Thank you for joining the program today. And before you go, please dedicate any positive potential to the enlightenment of all sentient beings. Have a great week and goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Kapari mai.